The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets managed to turn it around. Trade war escalations postponed. For now, Microsoft edges past Apple in market cap. Listener questions and our guest, Arthur Herman, author and senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. All this and much more on episode number 590 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to the show. Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz. I'm your host of this podcast each and every week where we come together and talk to some great people, some influential minds, and some real thinkers in the area of finance and broad reaching, as we'll see from our discussion today with someone who is outside of the area of specifically, you know, finance investments, but business is something that he knows a lot about. We're going to be talking to him very shortly. And I want to mention also, of course, on Tuesday evenings, DH Unplugged, myself and John C. Dvorak, talk it up pretty good. And go over all the news of the week, business, investing, finance, corporate America, some politics here and there sprinkled in for a little bit of fun. But basically, we come together, talk live at 9 p.m. Eastern time, and it's a show you don't want to miss. So check that out, DH Unplugged. You can, of course, get the recordings and the shows not live, if you want to do so, on any of your favorite podcast repositories. So here we are. It's the start of December. November's over. Some pretty wild chop throughout the month. I mean, it was pretty intense throughout pretty much every day. I mean, every day there was a movement one way or another. Tape bombs all over the place. We saw the headline minefield that we had to walk through to get to where we were at the end. And really only the last week and probably the last several days of the week that were spectacular enough to bring most major indices to a positive reading by the close of the month. Now, we saw that value beat growth from the start of the month to the end of the month. And this is a trend that we have seen that has been growing. Value is seemingly taking over growth as people are looking for safety alternatives, not wanting to pay the high prices, the high PEs, the high ratios, if you will, the exceptional costs related to growth on concerns that maybe there's some growth slowdown coming up. And we don't want to really extend ourselves and pay too much for a particular stock. Therefore, switching over, rotating into more of a value orientation. We're seeing some stress in the credit markets, not anything that's been too troubling right now, but much different than we saw, let's say, at the beginning of the year, where the credit markets were just fine. Really, no cracks there at all, no concerns, nothing happening. We're starting to see that there is a separation now between the quality and lower quality. And we're starting to see that there is some murmurs and some hints, we'll say, that there is some trouble brewing in the credit markets. And we know that the credit markets are oftentimes much smarter than the equity markets. So just keep an eye on that. Watch your junk bond funds, ETFs, et cetera. See how they're performing. See how some of the lower rated are performing as compared to the higher rated in treasuries, et cetera. And keep an eye on that. That will be a good tell as to what's going on. What we saw over the weekend was pretty interesting. There was an announcement by both United States and China at the G20 meeting that, well, here we go. Good news, possibly. Maybe there's going to be some more upside due to the fact that now there is a postponement in the escalation of the trade war between China and the U.S. It's going to be pushed out about 90 days. What that means is that these additional tariffs on possibly more goods and on the current goods that were already at 10%, were moving to 25% at the beginning of the year. So I guess there was some discussion about, hey, let's let this go on a little bit longer just to frustrate the hell out of investors to keep this gigantic, enormous ominous black cloud over their head for a while longer. Why not? Let's postpone this for another 90 days and do nothing to get a resolution otherwise. Let's just talk more. Let's just say what we want to say. Let's say that we're winning on the U.S. side and that you're winning on the China side. So we appease your markets on both sides so we can have a nice seasonal rally and a Santa Claus rally to the end of the year and make everybody really happy. That's the message I got from what came out. Because it was a wish list, a hope list. Maybe we'll do this. We're going to try to do this. We intend to do this. It's the usual political gibberish, blather, pretty much, that each side can claim victory for without actually getting anything done. So there's a whole list of things that they're going to do. The China's going to buy more agricultural products in a big way. We're going to postpone and try and negotiate, but of course, the way we do it here is put a little bit of hook on the end. If, in fact, by the end of 90 days, no progress is made with some of the intellectual property issues as well as the trademark issues and just a variety of other unfair practices that we believe China is perpetrating on United States business, then we are going to pretty much ramp it right back up. So, in other words, we're no better off now. We're no worse off now than we were a couple of months ago. Because back a couple of months ago, we thought everything was going to start moving up on the first of the year. It reminds me of a parent that said, hey, listen, if you don't do what I say, you got to do what I say. Hey, we're going to punish you a little bit. I'm going to count to three. We're going to count one, two. We're going to do it. Three, four, five. We're kind of at the four level right now where we just keep on talking and all that. So we'll have to see how this plays out, but it probably will be to the benefit of investors, as at least there is nothing imminent that is going to be happening right now. So keep a watch on what happens to the end of the year, especially with some of the seasonal trends to the upside that could be building up. So I want to get to the guest right away. I'll mention that right after we talk with him, I'm going to pull up some of the listener questions that you sent in. And when, of course, we're going to give away a book to one lucky listener that sent in a question. It's a random pick from the questions that you send in. And we'll send you a book by book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. And we'll get that right out to you. Of course, you get that on audiobook, etc. So go check that out for the holidays. In the meantime, you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on the Ask Andrew button, and then just simply ask a question, and we'll review it for inclusion in the shows through the end of this year and answer them and do our best to have a little fun with it. So with that, let's get moving. And we have a very special guest with us today, Dr. Arthur Herman from the Hudson Institute, and author of the book, Freedom's Forge. And I had the opportunity to get this recommendation to read this book from a listener. And so thank you very much for that. And we have the great honor and privilege of talking to Dr. Herman today. So how are you, sir?
Well, it's an honor and privilege to join you today as well.
So I got
to
tell you, so this book, and I'm going to, I'll tell you the word that comes, riveting, and that's obviously somewhat, yes. I think appropriate for this particular book. It's all about the idea that during World War, and prior to World War II, the incredible ability and coalition of American businesses that came to the charge to really help out create the, as we call it, the arsenal of democracy, the military buildup, right?
Right.
So what brought you to desire to write this book, first of all?
Well, I think one of the things that anyone who has worked on World War II military equipment, and I have been working on naval strategy and naval, capacity building during World War II when I was writing my Royal Navy book, To Rule the Waves, How the Royal Navy Shaped the Modern World. And one of the things that I found quite fascinating was the degree to which the Royal Navy, by 1943 on, the last 2 years of the war, really had become dependent on American shipyards to keep them equipped with the supply ships, the famous Liberty ships that kept Britain alive and in the war, but also for their destroyers, for their cruisers, for their landing craft. The British Navy was really, in many ways, an American-made Navy. And I think that overlaps with something that almost anyone who looks at the amazing story of America's ability to ramp up its wartime production from basically zero when the war broke out in Europe in 1939 to supplying two-thirds of all of the equipment and all of the military hardware that all of the Allies used in World War II, you kind of have to ask, how did this happen? Well, there's a standard myth that has been circulating for a number of decades, which has been that this was all the federal government that did this, that after bombs dropped on Pearl Harbor, FDR said, we're really going to get going here, and we're going to turn America's factories and America's industrial plant and all of its workers over to wartime production. And it all happened with a kind of a wave of the U.S. government wand.
Right.
And what I did in this book was to really show, and I think now it's pretty broadly accepted, that in fact that the initiative for getting America ready and prepared for war and actually carrying it out and then sustaining it beyond the war really lies with private industry. And it lies with one particular man, and that was Big Bill Knudsen, who was the CEO of General Motors when Roosevelt called him in the summer of 1940 and said, we have got a big problem. War is coming to us very soon, given the Nazi conquest of Europe, and we need to be prepared for this. But also really to a whole coterie of American corporate executives, of designers and planners and engineers, and just the ordinary men and women who worked in these plants and worked flat out in incredible hours, as I point out in the book, with incredible risks to their own health and safety, who enabled us to defeat enemies on two fronts and to build America from what had been the 16th largest military at the start of the war into the world's dominant military superpower.
So, you know, what's interesting is that if my recollection is correct, that there was before this, there was a concept that, you know what, we want to demilitarize. In fact, you know, we're tired of what the money that we spent during World War One, and nobody wanted to really be involved in it. And it took a lot of work to get Roosevelt really believing that they would get involved. And there was this whole idea that we would, you know, go through this appeasement process until I think Churchill called one day and said, listen, if they get our ships here and if the Nazis come over and they take over the Royal Navy, the biggest Navy in the world at that time, then they're coming right for you. And I think that was a light bulb that went off and kind of turned the whole process around and realized, well, Roosevelt was being very stubborn about this, not wanting to really do this, that maybe we need to start get something going in the background.
Yeah, I mean that telegram that he got from Churchill, warning him of what the consequences would be if Germany really were able to conquer the British Isles and then control the Royal Navy, that this would really be a disaster for the United States to have Nazi control over the access and the sea lanes of the Atlantic, really galvanized Roosevelt into action. But the action that he took was to call Bill Knudsen. It was to realize that there was no way the federal government was going to be able to do this by diktat or by reliance on the very sketchy facilities the U.S. Army and Navy had for large-scale military buildup, that you'd have to unleash the real power and energy of America's peacetime industry, its largest commercial industrial base, in order to get the United States ready to confront an enemy like Germany. Japan wasn't even on the horizon at that point, the summer of 1940. But of course, after December of 1941, the fact that America had that year and a half to start gearing up and start to set the plans for large-scale mobilization really paid off because it enabled us to wage a two-front war, which would have been really, really impossible if the buildup hadn't started when it did.
So, you know, in the book, it seemed to me, if you were to play this out as it was, the key actors in this whole drama that unfolded, it would be Knudsen, of course, would be the one that was, and Kaiser. And there was that competition constantly.
Henry Kaiser. Right.
But the names in the book that just kept, I mean, every time you would talk about some of the people, the Fords and all the people in Detroit, DuPonts, and it was, I was just taken aback by just every name in the industry, industrialized world, and they all got involved.
They all did. And Stephen Bechtel of Bechtel Corporation, Henry Kaiser, you mentioned him. Of course, his name lives on with the Kaiser Foundation and Kaiser Permanente, but it's important to realize that Henry Kaiser's real expertise was in road construction, in large-scale construction of infrastructure projects like dams. And it was really on his own hook that he realized America is going to need all of this expertise that I've assembled in the world of infrastructure construction to build military hardware, from ships, the famous Liberty ships, to steel, to aircraft. You had this enormous unleashing, not just of industrial productivity. Everybody recognized that and have talked about it, but also to enormous unleashing of American ingenuity and innovation, and of companies that did things like, I talk about one company based in Richmond, Virginia, for example, that made the wooden shells for radio sets. You know, the hardware that goes with the radio sets. And so they shifted over and began manufacturing ammunition boxes for the U.S. Army. And all this was done not because the government said you've got to do this. These were people volunteering and saying we can retrain our personnel, we can reorganize our assembly line, and turn out the kind of products that you need in order to win this war. And from one part of the United States to the other, what you see is one executive or a handful, in some cases, engineers at a company who make this pledge and who make this change. I mean, I got to tell you, writing this book, it was really hard to stop because the number of amazing stories that came and of companies, even well-known companies today, who you come to realize had made this enormous, even indispensable contribution to winning World War II. I felt it was important to document that and to really give credit to the people and to the companies and to the technologies that they unleashed.
Yeah, you know, but the competition part of it, which is really, I thought, was really mind-blowing in terms of not competition for the sake of I'm the best, but competition to beat and be the best. In so much as, you know, you'd have the requirement to build, let's just say, 50 planes this month and then 75 and 100. And they would come up with ways. See, if the government was just doing this, they would just go along the plan of what was required.
That's right.
And probably fall short. Right. But then they would come up with
exactly
new and
right.
ingenious ways. Like you said, the Liberty ships, how they turned a mud flap into this incredible, almost an open air production facility to build these things, right? I mean, just amazing.
Running 24/7.
Right.
And running around in Richmond, California. And then a similar set of yards in Portland, Oregon. And then Kaiser getting the heads of the two shipyards, including his son, competing with each other at who could build a Liberty ship the fastest.
Just amazing.
Or another one of my favorite stories, too, is what happened when General Electric was approached by the U.S. Army, and they said, we need to have a weapon that we can use to shoot at tanks, an anti-tank weapon that'll penetrate armor. And the GE engineer said, okay, what have you got in mind? And so he gave him basically a sketch, you know, on a piece of paper saying, do you think this would work? And the GE engineer sort of said, well, let's set out and find out. And in a matter of weeks, they managed to move over teams and assembly line from the GE plants in order to create this thing that no one had ever created before, and to develop and test and then to field them. He called it the bazooka, came out of this, you know, of asking GE. Now, they had never made bazookas. They had never really made military hardware. They made lights and electrical facilities and components for military trucks. But the fact was, there was a pride in being GE engineers. We can solve any problem you put in front of us. And that sense of pride, even doing things that no one had done before, is what really, I think, you see the World War II mobilization tapped into. And that's something which I think, when we think about American ingenuity, talk about American innovation, it's one of the things that I think we sorely need today when we think about where our defense industrial base is today and where it's going to be in the future.
I want to get to that. But as I was reading the book, the whole time, because you not only in the book talked about these stories, but had incredible detail about discussions that went on. And like you mentioned, somebody just drew something on a napkin. That's not necessarily a story that's chronicled somewhere, right? That's just readily available. How did you get all this information?
Well, a lot of it was published during the war and after the war, too, because so many of these companies and associations, like the Automobile Manufacturers Association, were deeply proud of what they had accomplished. You know, and so that pride made them advertise and talk to the American public during the war, and then then their accomplishments afterwards. They made no bounds about what it had involved. And when you read the stories, or when you go into the documentation in the archives and so on, what you see is more often than not that the government representative or the person who's come from the U.S. Navy or from the Army, because there was no Pentagon then, it was the War Department and the Department of Navy that oversaw all this activity, that by and large, they are very much the fifth wheel in all this. Their contribution more often than not proves to be an obstacle to getting things done faster and getting things accomplished. That it is the drive and the push and the dynamic of America's mobilization in World War II really was, in many ways, a bottoms-up and mid-level push. Of course, encouraged by the executives at the top, but you had your whole workforce behind this and pushing hard in this direction, because they knew this was a war that had to be won, and it was sons and brothers and sweethearts whose lives depended on having the equipment they would need in order to accomplish the missions that they were set out to do.
So now that we know that there's these people that were bigger than life, and Knudsen was a big guy, right?
He was very tall. That's right. Exactly. He was a former boxer. He was a former boxer in the shipyards where he got his start in New York when he emigrated from Denmark.
So we have all these big names and the names that live on, of course, and some of the ancillary players in this and the people that were who are these people today? If in other words, if we had the same circumstance today, who would be called?
Well, you know, that is an excellent question. And you're asking I won't even say the $60,000 question. I'd say it's a $6 million question, or maybe even a larger figure than that. When I first published this book, people would ask me that question. And my standard answer was, yes, we can do this again. Because when we look at where America is today, in terms of advanced technologies, you look at Silicon Valley, you look at the expertise that lies in areas like telecommunications and so on, that all it is that, and these are going to be the weapon systems of the future. These are going to be the ways in which wars are won and lost in the future. And that mobilizing these guys and incentivizing these people, once we can do that, then the building of a new arsenal of democracy will emerge. But now I have to say, I'm beginning to realize that the big question is that if. Mm-hmm. And that is if you can incentivize. Because right now, in fact, I did a seminar this summer over at the National Defense University, and they had a whole discussion about rapid mobilization. Can America's defense industrial base mobilize rapidly for a protracted conflict with what they called a near peer competitor, which means China, Russia too, but mostly China. And I said the biggest obstacle we face today is not economic, it's not technological, it's cultural. And that is when Bill Knudsen went around to his fellow corporate executives and said, America needs these equipment. We need planes. We need tanks. We need the equipment. We need to win a war. They saluted and they said, yes, my country's calling. The president's calling. You can count on us, Bill. I'm not sure if Silicon Valley will respond with quite that kind of enthusiasm today. I think what we've seen is that much of what motivates the leading manufacturers and designers in those industries often are agendas which run, shall we say, counter to our national or patriotic aims in that way. They respond more to sort of globalist agenda from that point of view. And one of the big problems we're going to face and we're going to have to go ahead and try and deal with is how do we get the best and brightest in those advanced technologies, the ones that will be decisive on the battlefield, in cyberspace, I mean, and in space. How do we incentivize them to bring their expertise and their knowledge and their enthusiasm for innovation and for getting ahead to our national defense needs? And that's a serious challenge because a lot of them talk about, you know, the military-industrial complex, that whole stereotype. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to become part of the military. It grew out of the Vietnam years, and that the idea that this is this great evil machine that goes out and kills people and runs down indigenous peoples in the third world and so on, and the experience that we've had with drones and the Predator strikes hasn't helped with that, overcome that stereotype, let's say. And so when you get, you know, employees at Google, for example, protesting and saying they don't want to be part of Project Maven, which was a program for facial identification of terrorists that they feared could be used to kill terrorists through drone strikes, you begin to see that there's a mindset there which has to be dealt with, and it has to be there's a bridge that has to be built between where our Pentagon is and where our national defense needs are and where the people who can best meet those needs in the future are themselves, culturally speaking.
Yeah.
And that's a big topic, but it's one that I'm now devoting myself to do, and that I try to use Freedom's Forge as a way to sort of say, look, there are ways to bridge that gap, because there was a lot of disagreement, you know, especially before the war broke out, about whether this was a good thing, about whether America would be better off remaining neutral instead of helping allies like Britain and France, because originally our arsenal democracy began as a means to arm the British against
through the Lend-Lease program.
Through the Lend-Lease program, right. And even before that. And there were a lot of people who thought that this was getting America into waters that it should not venture into. So, and, you know, Roosevelt was a very unpopular president in a lot of areas, especially in the corporate executive boardrooms. So these are not problems that disappear. You know, they were unknown or non-existent in the World War II era.
But, you know, it's very easy for people to have an opinion when they're not threatened.
That's right.
So that all changes a lot. You know, and that's what happened in the beginning of this, when, you know, there was this kind of like, all right, it's over there. Just we're not part of that. But when it starts creeping over into your own backyard, all of a sudden you can have a strong opinion on one thing. But then, you know, you have to become flight or fight. And that's going to change the whole dynamic.
There you go. That's perfectly true. And look, after December 7th, the debate went away.
Right. Exactly. But
as I point out in my book, it was very crucial that this process for arming America and getting America's factories and plants geared up for war, it had to come well before that. Otherwise, we would have been in deep, even more serious trouble than we were on December 8th, 1941.
Just quickly, I just mentioned this and I have another question. The names that came to me, by the way, I don't know if I'm right about this, are Branson, maybe Bezos, and Musk. Those are the only three.
Okay, I'm going to throw one. I'll throw one name into that, Peter Thiel.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah. Yep.
And I think he is also somebody who has sensed that where Silicon Valley is culturally is not where it needs to be in order to serve this country in the best possible way. And I think you could see someone like Thiel helping to assemble the team that you just talked about and getting them to really mobilize and to bring their other the other executives in Silicon Valley and beyond into the mix. But you put your finger on one of the key issues here, and that is a question of leadership.
Yep.
And there's no doubt in my mind, as I by the time I finish this book, if it had it without Bill Knudsen's leadership, it wouldn't have been possible for America to produce victory in World War II. Because even those executives who had their doubts about Roosevelt, or even had their doubts about getting America involved in a war over on the other side of the Atlantic, in a faraway place we know very little about and have small connections with, the fact that Bill Knudsen called on them to do it, they trusted him, they respected him. He was a giant in the world, not just in the automobile industry, but in all the related industries. And when Bill Knudsen gave you a call, you answered. And that's the kind of leader that I'm not sure we have right now, but I think that it's one that
it can be developed.
If this administration is smart, they begin to think about someone who can lead and bring the other executives in our high-tech industries on board.
But so are we prepared today? So I had a discussion with a friend of mine who is, kind of a bit of a history buff. He's actually in the area of law enforcement. And he was telling me that right now that a lot of people are of the mindset that America's military is really ill-equipped to fight a war with, like you said, a China or Russia, where all of our money is going into sand and desert type of efforts, trying to root out people from caves, et cetera. And we're really
war on terror.
Yeah. And we have no, I don't want to call it conventional because there is no conventional anymore, right? We're not using muskets and knives, but that more conventional style, are we totally ill-prepared right now?
Well, your friend is right. And in fact, the most recent report that came out of the Office of Trade and Manufacturing Policy, with whom I correspond and discuss these matters often, their latest report was pretty dismal about what we call the defense industrial base. Where would we produce the trucks, the tanks? Where do we get an aircraft that we would need for a conflict that lasted more than, a couple weekends? Where do we get the munitions? Where do we get the maintenance and replacement that would be required if you found yourself in a protracted conflict that, lasted for a month or more? It's a real challenge. But what will really make the difference, though, is not just the industrial base of those kinds of, as you were saying, conventional weapons, but also the next generation of weapons.
Yeah.
When we look at robotics, when we look at what they call autonomous systems, which include drones and unmanned undersea vehicles, when we look at artificial intelligence, and that's a big buzzword now in Washington today, when we look at quantum technology, and I do a lot of work on that currently here at Hudson Institute on quantum technology and the ways in which quantum computers will become a really decisive factor in future conflicts, particularly with China, then you have to say we also need to think about that defense industrial base and the ways in which those technologies are going to evolve. But there's one factor now which is beginning to focus minds, at least here in Washington, and maybe also in other parts of the country, and that's China.
Yep.
And the rise of China as an increasingly aggressive presence in the Indo-Pacific, in its cyber theft practices, in its predatory approach to trade, all of which goes to help to reinforce its military clout, its building of a navy which is specifically directed to wreck and to displace our navy on the seven seas. All of these kinds of things are beginning to focus people's minds on how will we be prepared for this conflict? How will we be prepared? We're kind of at the point now, as I'm thinking about it, we're kind of at the point now where we were maybe in the summer of 1940, where we've got that sort of year and a half window in which we really can think seriously about what our defense needs are going to be in the future, which, as you just correctly point out, it's probably not going to be conflicts out in the areas where our battles in Iraq and Afghanistan have taken place and where so much of our resources and personnel have been directed and thinking about how to fight wars. but we're going to be thinking instead about wars that bear much more resemblance to where we were in World War II in the Pacific, with large-scale naval, air, and amphibious forces engaged in a range of conflicts over vast areas of distance, and economic warfare too, which I think, to my point of view, we are already in that conflict with China. And certainly China thinks so.
Yeah.
And they're pressing forward. They're pressing forward on all these fronts, including the high-tech fronts and AI and quantum technology and in robotics and unmanned systems. And we've just got to get our minds around the fact that this is a competition which we can't afford to lose, that the free world can't afford to lose. And there, again, the parallels with the story I tell in Freedom's Forge, I think, are quite apt.
What was looking back at all the things, the culmination of all the various events, the you know, small thing here of, for example, I think this, some of the things that stuck out was, for example, the story of how there were tanks that were built with rivets. And I think it was Kaiser, if I'm not mistaken, who, the problem was that when a bomb went off near a tank, it didn't damage the tank, but it blew out the rivets internally, killing all the people in the tank, right?
And yeah, exactly. That was actually Knudsen. Knudsen realized that there was something really wrong and that you had to shift from rivets to welding, and that you could build a really strong weld that would hold for a tank in battlefield conditions.
So you had that. You had, for example, the Liberty ships being built in incredible quantities and being just, I mean, days, it would be days till they build one of these things and ship them out. And then you had the airplanes that were being built in incredible numbers, the ammunition, the women that came in. What was the turning point? What was the thing that you stuck out as like, that really was a key part that really helped us win the war?
Boy, that's a very tough question to answer if you had to point at one single turning. I can give you the turning point in terms of dates was probably in the spring of 1942 when the U.S. was on target to outproduce not only Great Britain as a leading manufacturer of military equipment, but was about to outstrip the entire Axis. Germany, Italy, and Japan combined. And at that point, I think in terms of production of trucks, production of Jeeps, production of a vehicle, of course, which did not exist until Bill Knudsen oversaw the competition to find a light vehicle that the Army could use for patrol purposes. Ships, landing craft. The gears were in so much in motion, and had achieved such a level of sort of perpetual motion that the real problem, as I explain in the book, by 1944, there's still a year to go in the spring of 1944. The real problem everyone realized was not how do we produce more, but how do we slow this thing down? Because as the inevitability of Allied victory became clear, the question then became, how do we stop and turn off the spigot, or at least slow it down? Because we were so geared up for producing military hardware that it was bound to have an effect on the peacetime economy after the war, unless something were some way in which we're found to sort of slow things down. And this is why in June of 1944, when you read the trade papers in America's leading industries, the big discussion there is about T-Day, not D-Day, not the overlord landings in Normandy, but termination day. In other words, how do you go about now preparing for the termination of your government contract so that you can go back and transition back to peacetime production and back to making the products that you originally had set out to do. And of course, the great thing, amazing thing was, is that companies were able to do this. And it was very few companies that had found themselves having overextended with wartime production that couldn't shift back for and even be in a stronger position because of what they had learned from the wartime production techniques And of streamlining their assembly lines and working with employees and training employees in the fastest possible way to get the best possible results. All of these things became, you know, key virtues when it came to getting America's industrial might geared back up to consumer goods and back to commercial production.
Right. There was a lot of people that were predicting that it would be a Great Depression after that.
Oh yeah, right.
That's, you know,
right.
That you know,
of course. Yeah.
Even though you'd have all these people coming, all these military folk coming home and having to need some housing of some sort, and all that, but all of a sudden this incredible vacuum. You know, you had to start back up Detroit again, right? I mean, Detroit was only producing.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, military.
That's right. They had stopped commercial production of automobiles, and they were going to have to transition back. And of course, what all these economists assumed, and we bump into economists like that today, what they all assumed was that the federal government isn't telling industry what to do. They won't know what to do. You know, they'll be helpless because they've been giving orders by the federal government, by the War Department, the Navy Department, and then if they don't get any more orders, the poor things, they won't have anything to do, and the capacity will shut down.
Right.
And of course, the opposite turned out to be the case. And Bill Knudsen's great boss, Alfred Sloan, predicted correctly that the end of the war wouldn't bring a depression. It wouldn't bring a catastrophic fall off of production and mass unemployment, but that American industry would come roaring back stronger and more productive than ever. And of course, it was really true. As I describe at the end of the book, I talk about the way in which, after a slight hiccup right after the war ended, the American economy really moved into fifth gear and began to produce this enormous industrial and economic miracle of the 1950s that was sustained all the way through for the next two decades. It's an extraordinary story, but it's not really so much about World War II production. It's rather about American business.
Yep.
And what it can really accomplish when it sets its mind to doing
it. That's exactly the point. I mean, the point is, if you wrap this all up and you kind of look at this, it really is all about the incredible abilities, from a top-down standpoint, from a bottoms-up standpoint, the tenacity of American business and the people employed at America. I mean, it is a patriotic story, for goodness sakes. I mean, it is really inspiring in so many ways. But really, from a business standpoint, it shows the flexibility, ability. It just shows the incredible desire of a business from as an organism, if you will, right, to maintain its existence through any kind of adversity. I think that's what I really got out of it.
That's a beautiful way to put it. That's a beautiful way to put it. And I'll tell you, the other thing this book has done too is it's had an effect here in Washington and over across the river from me in the Pentagon in terms of getting the people there to think about what a real defense industrial base is all about. And I know the book has been circulating around, at Lockheed Martin at their famous Skunk Works, you know, their big innovative lab that they've got set up. My book is required reading there for every new person who comes in to join the enterprise. And to realize that defense industrial base in the end really depends upon the energies and the motivations and the ingenuities of the people working in the private sector, not on government diktat. You can't get people to do their best in a command economy. You have to unleash the best by appealing to what it is that drives and incentivizes the private economy.
Yep.
And that's where the heart of innovation lies and where it comes from.
Yep. Arthur Herman.
So I'm very pleased about that too. I got one more.
Well, go
I got
ahead.
One
more I can, story I can stay you. All day with you. Well, I'm fascinated by this.
I can
whole
stay
thing.
All day. I know. I'll tell you, this is a story which actually is not in the book, but people will ask me after I talk about it or they've read it, they sort of say, what was the company that was the most productive in World War II? You talk about all these, you know, Ford and GM and Studebaker and the ammunition makers and the others and so on. What was the number one productive company? And the answer I have to give, believe it or not, is Hershey's.
Really?
And Hershey's, the candy company, because In 1940, the U.S. Navy came to Hershey's and they said, we need you. We need what they call, it was called D rations. Now, everyone's heard about C rations that service personnel eat. But D rations were survival rations that would be, that it would keep sailors or aviators who had gone down in the ocean or in remote places alive by being able to, you know, eat this sort of survival ration that they would have with them. And they were going to be sewn into every life jacket, sewn into life boats, in survival and medical kits. And it was called a D-ration. And they said, what we want you to do is to produce our D-ration, but what we need is a chocolate that tastes bad. Because if it tastes good, what we're worried about is that people will eat it before they're actually, you know, in the survival, in desperate straits, and they need the thing.
Right.
And so the Hershey executives all got together and they said, gosh, can we make a chocolate that tastes bad? And they said, yes, I think we can. And so they did, and they came up with this thing, and the people who eat it said it has about the same taste and consistency of mashed potatoes. But they produced 2.5 billion of these D rations during the war. That's a billion with a B.
Yeah, that's unbelievable.
And in fact, last time I looked when I was writing the book, you can still buy D rations made by Hershey's on eBay.
Wow.
I mean, that's how long they've lasted. And I've not eaten one of them, so I can't testify to what the taste is. But as far as I know, that's the single most productive output from the World War II.
And when you say billions, it's not billions today billions. It's yesterday's billions, when billions was like, oh my. You know, billions today.
A billion little of these little tasteless chocolate bars.
Yep. I mean, amazing. Great stuff. Amazing. Well, keep up the great work. I appreciate you coming on, Dr. Arthur Herman from the Hudson Institute. You got to get his book, Freedom's Forge, available everywhere. So check it out. Appreciate you coming on.
Anytime.
All right. Thanks. Man, I enjoyed that. That was pretty cool. What a great mind. And the information is just, I find it just fascinating. Hope you did too. I thought it was really pretty neat. Let's get to our listener questions right now. And we have three here. I have from Brian Harvison. He says, hey, Andrew. Hey, I love the show. I'm a 3-year veteran listener, which is awesome. Thank you so much for listening. You bring some great guests out who give us investors different sides of this complex market system we have. He says, I like Frank Curzio because when you try to dissect the market, you don't cut each other any slack. It's kind of this honest interview process that I and others depend on. Well, thanks so much. Appreciate you recognizing that, doing our best to bring it to you. So he asked a question about the 2016. In 2016, the market was all about value funds. They were up and growth funds were down. After the election that year, growth was up and value was down. Are we experiencing a reversal of that? In other words, is growth all sizes of that market out and value is about to resume? You know, it's interesting because machines and algos and there's just a high frequency traders, they're all part of this market. Things happen in a bigger way, sometimes quicker, but in a bigger way, more exaggerated way, it seems to me. So when you get a particular trend that will play out, so for example, let's just say that the election, and we figure there'll be a deregulation, there'll be growth. What you have was the banks moving up pretty strongly, and you had at that time also, technology starting to take off. The idea that tax cuts will really help out certain sectors of the markets versus others, and a variety of the other things that will go on with a business-friendly government. Well, of course, what happened was that everybody attacked it, and growth really played out very strongly. And what happened because of that was it wasn't even. It was very uneven. Value-oriented things like utilities with the thought that, well, the economy will speed up, interest rates will go higher. And you put all these basic theories down economically and investment-wise. And what happens is you get this outsized move in various sectors, subsectors, industries, markets. So I think what you're saying is exactly true. And I think, of course, it's important to recognize that what we saw for a long time was that there was a bent towards value. Then growth for 2.5 years or so really outpaced value significantly to a point that we had said at the beginning of this year, you know what? It's time to start looking at value, because you oftentimes see a reversion to the mean in various sectors to bring it back to, possibly surpass, but at least bring it back to the levels of long-term historical returns. And therefore, with that divergence that we saw in value over growth recently, it seems logical that value is going to eventually come back a bit and possibly be more of a safe haven. That exactly happened over the last 3 months. It didn't happen until then. There was some hints that it was going to be maybe value starting to play out, but it was only until about the last 3 months that value really started to come up a bit on a relative basis and growth collapsed. So good question. And you have to watch for those kinds of reversionary trades. Next question is from David Gurish. He says, "Hey, good day to you, Andrew. I hope the holidays find you well." And same to you. He has two questions. We're going to try to hit the first one here. He says, "I hope you could educate me with regard to this. First, I was looking at a stock with a high insider buying activity, but on the insider transaction section, one of the officers had a trade where the number of total shares was listed as zero. Does that mean that this person liquidated their entire holdings?" So what I would do is, oftentimes when you go to these insider trading sites where give you a culmination and summation of all the insider trading that went on, oftentimes you're able to click the particular person's name and find all their historical transactions. So what I would go is in and I would look and I would find how much of this was owned at any given time, just kind of glance through it, and then look to see if there was any significant changes by selling if it did drive it down to zero. Now, very rarely are insiders, if they are members of the board or if they are management, will have a zero amount of shares held. It's possible. I don't know what the reason would be, but it's possible. I don't know if I'd want somebody on my board that didn't believe in my company enough to buy the shares of the company, but it could very well mean that particular insider no longer has any shares and liquidated their entire position and they're out of it. And you just got to keep an eye on that and look at the history to see what it is. So I think that's would be helpful. Last question here today is Rita Tippy. I'm sorry for that, for butchering your name. Either way, but I think I covered it every possible way it can be pronounced. He says, "Hi." She says, "Hi, Andrew. I love the podcast and listen to it diligently every Monday morning on my way to work." Well, happy Monday to you, because you're listening now, obviously. "I really appreciate how you segregate and provide higher insight into the market conditions and separate it from the media noise. My question is," thank you. I do thank you very much, by the way. I appreciate that. "My question is, what are the basic financial indicators, signs that investors should be looking for to determine if it is worth investing in that company? Example, financial statements, balance sheets, etc. At the end of the day, financials are a source of truth and no one can rely on the aspirations of anticipated growth of the company. Thanks for that. And I hope for a chance for the book." So there is some, I think there's some truth in what you're saying here, however, with a giant caveat. So what you do mention is, and I agree with, is you look at the financials and understand what the underlying growth has been for things like return on equity, if that's solid and a solid number that's staying strong. You want to look at margin expansion. You want to look at growth signals in both revenue and in both earnings. There's a lot of things you want to look at, and then possibly where that's coming from. Is it internal? Is it from acquisition? Balance sheet, of course, what the balance sheet looks like from a debt to equity ratio, looking at their current assets. There's a lot of things you want to look at. However, remember that there is also a lot of shenanigans that can be played from quarter to quarter with the financials. So you want to look long term and look at the growth ranges of that. How have things progressed? Looking at it as a snapshot, or even just as compared to only, let's say, last quarter, may not be the best way to do it. You want to look at a year ago, the same quarter. That brings in some seasonality trends automatically into the research that you're doing. And it shows you how this company did 1 year ago in the same exact quarter. We really rely on that. looking at year over year in the same quarter. So when we go back, we always are comparing the same quarter this year, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and so on. You want to look at all the different indicators, I think, is very important. I think, though, at the end of that process, you may find a great company. Now, let's say you do this, and you're like, well, you know, this is a pretty good company. It's got good balance sheets, it's got good earnings. See that the growth trajectory is right. Management seems to be doing the right thing. They have a good ROE and all that's good. The stock, though, you look at the stock chart and you're like, wait a minute. Why is this thing down from 100 down to 50? Right? You're like, that doesn't work. I just did all this research, not looking at anything more, and it seemed like a good company. So it's possible that there's something else going on behind the scenes. Maybe there's a lawsuit that's pending over some weird situation that really hasn't been resolved yet and it's kind of laying out there. Maybe there was some issue with management. I don't know, make it up whatever you want it to be. So with that, you have to realize that markets are relatively efficient. And what you want to do is make sure to match the work that you've done from a financial standpoint, the fundamentals, with the technicals, giving you good insight of to what everybody else is seeing and what maybe you're missing. Because it will tell you some of the holes in your research by doing that. Then you can look further into what news came out, what's the information that may be out there that you didn't find. So it's kind of a multifaceted tour of the company from a fundamental, looking under the hood and seeing how it actually performs. It's kind of like a car. You do pick up the hood, the engine looks great. The car starts, can't get past 20 miles an hour. Obviously, it's something you missed. So the technicals will give you kind of the gauge on possibly what's going on otherwise and what the sentiment is surrounding it. So let's mix these up real quick. Closing my eyes. I'm just tossing these around and we're going to pick this one. Brian Harverson. So Brian, you won the book. Do me a favor. Go over to where you send me emails that you've done before, I think, especially the Ask Andrew section, and just send me your address and we will send you a copy of The Disciplined Investor in the mail immediately. So you'll have it for the holidays. Well, that's going to wrap it up for today. Thanks for joining me. Let me know what you thought. Do me a favor, retweet this. Let me know what you thought of our guest today, Arthur Herman. I'm not going to cloud your thoughts, but I thought he was great. But let me know what you thought about that. And even though he was off topic of investments necessarily, I think it was just some great insight into the American business, the abilities, the fortitude, and the inventiveness of American business. So with that, thanks for joining me, and I'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.